Good afternoon. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Tuesday, April 12, 2016. The time is 1:38 p.m. I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. Co-Chairman Kelly will join us shortly. With me at the table, Vice Chairman Michicki.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Bishop.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Hoffman.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
And Senator Dunleavy. As the state faces some tough times, the governor of the state of Alaska, as well as multiple senators and representatives, have tried to draw on intellectual capacity throughout Alaska and try to come up with a way that Alaska can face a $4.1 billion revenue shortfall and protect the people of Alaska, their pocketbooks, their jobs, and impact our business community in the least way possible. Today, the Senate is rolling out for the people's consideration, as well as the administration's consideration and this Finance Committee's consideration, in pencil, per the governor, a CS for Senate Bill 128, Permanent Fund Deposit Dividends Earnings. Senator Michicki, may I have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the CS for Senate Bill Number 128, Finance, Version 29-GS2859/N, before the committee is a working document.
I'll object for purposes of discussion and take a brief at ease while we pass out the CS. Brief at ease. For those of you at home, there should be posted a CS for Senate Bill 128/N, as in November. It's a working draft coming before the Senate Finance Committee. In addition, we have dated April 12, 2016, from our Legislative Finance Division, a model that we will be going through. And the next item that the Senate will start through is also a document that should be posted, and that is Alaska State Legislature Senate Finance Sectional Analysis for 128 Finance 29GS2859/N in November. Ms. Kramer, if you could start us through a walkthrough of our proposal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Laura Kramer, staff to Senator McKinnon. I'll just walk through the sections of the CS before the committee. Section 1 is legislative intent that asks the legislature to reevaluate the use of the earnings of the permanent fund in 3 years' time. Section 2 is AMLED HES income is no longer flowing to the capital income fund. Segregation of these funds is no longer legally required. Section 3, dedicated deposits of royalties to the permanent fund are reduced from the current 25-50 split on old and new leases to the constitutional minimum of 25%. Section 4 requires the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation to determine the net income of the earnings reserve account as the income is realized and received. B defines the percent of market value payout as 5.25% of the average year-end market value of the permanent fund and earnings reserve account for the first five of the most recently completed six fiscal years. The payout may not exceed the year-end balance of the earnings reserve account for the fiscal year just ended. Section 5 adds a new subsection and to AS 3713-145, which is the disposition of income of the permanent fund statute. A is unchanged, and that establishes the ERA and identifies the ERA as holding earnings of the permanent fund and ERA. B is repealed in this bill. This is the dividends based on statutory net income. C is also repealed in this bill. That is the inflation proofing. D is repealed in this bill, and that's the segregation of the Amaretta Hess. E is the new subsection, which is in Section 5 here. It states that each year the legislature may appropriate to the general fund the amount available for distribution from the earnings reserve account under the POMV that's laid out in Section 4B. Section 6, dividends are comprised of 20% of the 5.25% POMV outlined in Section 4 and 20% of prior year royalties, and this excludes those dedicated to the permanent fund or school fund. Those dedicated funds are 25.5%. Section 7, this is states that the Mental Health Trust Fund may not be included in the computation of income available for distribution under the POMV. Section 8 makes computation of Mental Health Trust Fund income consistent with computation of other permanent fund income. Section 9, transfers of money to the dividend fund requires an appropriation. Section 10, the amount of each permanent fund dividend for the fiscal years 2017, 2018, and 2019 shall be $1,000. Section 11 conforms to Section 9, which moves money to the dividend fund by appropriation. Section 12, once the money is in the dividend fund, the Department of Revenue shall annually pay dividends without further appropriation. Section 13 repeals language relating to the former dividend calculation, inflation proofing calculation, and the Amaretta Hess language. Section 14 repeals Section 10, which is the $1,000 dividend for 3 years. Section 15 states that the Commissioner of Revenue and the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation may adopt regulations, policies, and procedures to implement this act. Section 16 is the retroactivity clause. Section 17 is the effective date for Sections 15 and 16, which is immediate. And Section 18 is the effective date, July 1, 2016.
Are there questions from the committee on the CS / in November? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As you look at the permanent fund dividend is very important to everybody throughout the state. As you look at, Ms. Kramer, as you look at number 10, Section 10, I see the guarantee of $1,000, but if you go back to Section 6, it's 20% of the royalties that are out there. Do you have a ballpark figure of what those parameters might be as you look at the amount of the permanent fund might be during the years after 2019?
Senator Olson, if I might, if we could adopt the CS, we'll bring David Teal up, and we have charts and graphs for Alaskans to review that should answer that question. Ms. Kramer, did you have comments first?
No, Madam Chair. I was just going to say, Senator Olson, David Teal will walk through the output from the model, and there is a line that holds it pretty consistently around the $1,000 mark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No further questions.
I'd like to withdraw my objection to the adoption of the CS for Senate Bill 128 Finance / in November. Is there further objection to adopting the CS? Seeing and hearing none, the CS for Senate Bill 128 / in is before the committee. if I could invite Mr. Teal to the microphone and direct the people's attention to a graph that we've handed out today. It's also available on our website that will walk through how this particular proposal could impact Alaskans, how it works with our budget, how it works with the dividend check, what it does to our reserves, and how the permanent fund corpus grows. Mr. Teal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm David Teal, Director of Legislative Finance Division. I'm not sure which order these are in, mine are loose. I have the 6.9 on top. Is that the one you're looking at?
Three for these. We're back on the record. Mr. Teal, as I understand it, the permanent fund originally made a recommendation of 6.9% interest prospectively looking into Alaska's future, and the governor's model uses 7.45 as numbers. I've got heads saying no in the background. That's what we know as far as the models go. We're going to use the 6.9. If that's the governor's number, then we're in sync, so we'll clear that up. I'm getting a nod yes that that's the number that the governor is using, so that's why we chose 6.9. Mr. Teal.
I think the easiest place to start is to look at what goes into these graphs first, and that's down the center. So you'll see the price scenario at the top, spring 2016. That's the oil revenue forecast that we're using, or actually the full revenue forecast that we're using. We have no growth in the operating budget, at least no percentage growth, and in fact have a target cut there of $247 million, which is just a combination of cuts that are both House and Senate have in the operating budget, some guesses about what happens with capital. That number is subject to change. It's just an approximation at this point.
Mr. Teal, for those following, so the estimated capital that's projected in this model is $185 million. Is that accurate?
That's in the out years, yes.
Thank you.
Then there's community assistance. We have debt service as projected. We have no sales tax, income tax, motor fuel tax, or any other revenue enhancements built into the model at this time, except for the tax credit reform, and this output is the House finance version of that. And of course, we have no idea what might actually end up being the credit reform. So if you skip down to the blue, which is custom plan specifications, you'll see POMV payout of 5.25% with 20% of that payout going to dividends, an additional 20% going to dividends from royalties. So in answer to Senator Olson's questions, you can then look at the dividend check, which is the upper right graph. You'll see what dividends are under the current program, roughly $2,000. The dividends under this bill would be pretty steady at $1,000. There's that three-year cap of $1,000. Without that cap, the dividends would be somewhere in the $900 range and then move up to, that would be for 17, 18, and 19. And then from 20 on out, it would be the curve that's shown on the graph. We have that dividend of $1,000 through 19, and the only other thing perhaps worth mentioning is that we're assuming that this CBR, the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, earns more than its current 1 to 2%. There's nothing that we can do about that in the model. That's something that it is not in the bill, but there's been discussion of having the CVR invested more aggressively so that the returns on it are higher. There are a number of ways to do that, and it doesn't make a huge difference to the model because, as you can see in the lower left graph, the CVR balance under this model would fall to about $2 billion. So the earnings on that are significant, but don't make or break the model. So in the upper left corner graph, you'll see the UGF revenue and budget in it. And the expenditure line is the dark line on top. The bars going up are blue is oil. Basically, it's the normal revenue that we have, most of which is oil. Then you'll see, starting in 16, an orange bar. Orange indicates draws from the CVR. And beginning in 17, you'll see a green bar. That indicates the POMV draw from the earnings reserve account. So you can see that the deficit is narrowing, but that even through 2025, there is a deficit. The lower left graph shows reserve balances, and there you can see that reserves are expected to stabilize at about $12 billion. And the little table at the bottom of that graph shows reserves at in 25 of about $12 billion, 11.9. We still have a deficit, but because the deficit is low relative to what it is today, those reserves would be exhausted at the current deficit after 28 years. So I guess here it's worth noting that although our reserves in 17 are about $14 billion, we're spending them at a much more rapid rate, so there would be exhausted in 8 years or less. So reserve balance is slightly lower, but your deficit is so much lower that your glide path is much better under this bill than under the current, the status quo. Similarly, there's a little table on the right side that shows in the turquoise, it shows that the real value of the permanent fund is falling slightly over time. It does not keep pace with inflation at these earnings rates. It's 97%. You also note that although there is a nominal payout of 5.25%, there is a six-year lag in this. So the payout is based on the first five of the most recently completed 6 years. So because of that long look back, the effective payout is as shown in the lower right there at roughly 4.9%. Questions?
Mr. Teel, first, for the people of Alaska, it looks like there's a huge jump in spending from FY16 to FY17. Can you talk about why that is?
Madam Chair, there is actually a reduction in 17. I'm sure you know that. The difference is that in 16, the dividends are not shown as general fund expenditures, and this graph is showing only UGF expenditures. If FY16 dividends were shown on here, that line would be, instead of $5 billion, it would be $6.4 billion.
So for those following at home, and I know my grandson doesn't understand this, but because we're changing the way that we're calculating and paying out the dividend, it will now show up in our budget? Is that what you said?
Madam Chair, I think fair to say that right now, permanent fund dividends do not show as expenditures, as general fund expenditures. They show in the fiscal summary, but in a completely different section. So now under this bill, dividends will appear as general fund expenditures.
So there's no growth in the operating budget. So that's what I want to assure folks at home that are watching. It's an accounting it's an accounting change as we move forward in securing, in making what I call safer, sharing Alaska's financial endowment earnings responsibly. So we are trying to make it safer than some of the other proposals that we've seen. Mr. Teal, when Alaskans are looking in the upper left-hand corner at the budget and the black bar chart that goes across, and a reduction of spending in FY17, when we look at the green bar, which is the money that is starting to diversify Alaska's revenue streams, the bar in FY17, does that represent approximately a $2.4 billion draw, or if not, could you give me another number?
That's approximately right.
And then in FY2025, is it accurate that that raises to a draw of $3 billion, which is coming closer to what the governor had asked the legislature for?
Madam Chair, the draw does increase as the permanent fund and the earnings reserve increase. So it, I guess you could say it grows with inflation.
Thank you.
And reaches close to three.
And then, Senator Olten, you asked if you look at the upper right-hand box when we look at tracking the dividend check under this scenario. The dividend check remains fairly steady based on the spring forecast of about $1,000 in perpetuity. And so the difference is that we had the governor's plan. We have SB 114 that was the McGuire proposal. We had over in the House something from Representative Hawker. And this tries to blend everybody's good work together to stabilize the dividend for the people of Alaska and still use the bulk of the assets that we have in the form of earnings to diversify Alaska's revenue stream. If you look at the lower left-hand corner, Mr. Teal talked about it, that is stabilizing our draw on reserves. Right now we're looking at removing $7 billion over 2 years to pay for expenses that we currently have. And then the permanent fund itself and the corpus, sounds like we still need to do more work on making sure that we don't lose any kind of stability on growing the corpus itself. I know I have questions, Senator Dunleavy, Senator Hoffman, Senator Michiki, Senator Olson.
Thank you, through the Chair. Mr. Teal, on the graph on the upper left.
Senator Dunleavy, could you pull that mic just a bit closer?
Through the Chair, Mr. Teal, that graph on the upper left. It would appear that we're looking at spending in this particular scenario in this graph of about 5.2 to 3 billion. Is that correct?
Through the Chair, that's correct.
And so if we were to drive that down closer to 4, obviously we could extend our reserves and have less draw on the permanent fund. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. Okay, and the only reason I highlight that, Madam Chair, it's not an issue with the actual the bill and mechanism that you rolled out. It's just that I just need people to understand that as you push down your spending, you extend the life of your savings and you extend the life of your permanent fund as well. And so, like you said earlier, I think at one time, it's like a balloon. I mean, if you push one side, something's going to happen. But I just need the public to know that this represents spending at about 5.3, and it's our intention to get this well below 4.6, 4.5. I'm throwing that number out. But anyway, long story short, if you push the spending down, you can extend the life of all of this.
Absolutely. Senator Dunleavy, if I might follow up. Mr. Teal, then, is there $700 million worth of new money showing for the first time in Alaska's history for the permanent fund in that spending line? So there is no increase to the operating budget. There is a reflection now of permanent fund dividends going out to the people of Alaska.
That's correct, and I might also note that what Senator Dunleavy refers to as the 5.3, remember that 5.2 to 5.3 billion now includes approximately $700 million of dividends, so that in conventional terms here, you're looking at about a $4.5 billion budget.
And that's all that I wanted to get on the record. I want the people to be as clear as possible that there's continued pressure in a downward way on the budget, and this does not solve all of Alaska's problems, but it goes a long way into stabilizing our future as it exists today. Senator Hoffman, were you next?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. David, on the bottom left, basically it shows the budget reserves with no growth going out to 2053, and that would deplete all of our savings. Is that correct? 28 plus the 25. It says years to exhaust.
Okay, through the chair, Senator Hoffman, those years to exhaust, really, it's simple math. If you look at 17, where we have $14 billion in reserves, but we're spending at the rate of $2 billion, so roughly 6 years at that level of deficit and that level of reserves before you burn through your reserves. Similarly, if you go out to FY25, your reserves are lower at $11.9 billion, but your deficit is very much lower, $432 versus $2.2 billion. So although you have lower reserves, they're lasting much longer, 28 years.
So with no growth, that would those reserves would be exhausted in 2053.
Simple math, Mr. Teel, simple.
Simple math, but you hate to get that accurate with projections of this kind, but yes.
Well, you're pretty accurate. You say 28. 28 plus 25 is simple math. It's 2053.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Machicki.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions. First of all, what are the factors that make the corpus of the fund grow faster under this scenario versus status quo?
Through the chair, it's not just the corpus of the fund. When we show permanent fund ending balance in the lower right graph, that balance includes both the earnings reserve and the corpus. What makes them grow is you're still getting 25% of royalties deposited to the corpus every year, and that's more than royalties, it's leases, etc., etc., as defined in the Constitution. And second is that you're earning 6.9% but paying out 5.25%, or really lower than that, so that anything above your payout, any earnings above your payout remain in the fund. So it's, in effect, although inflation proofing provision was repealed, there's still inflation proofing here. It's just not so explicitly stated.
Senator Machicki.
It's kind of more of a statement, but I'd still like to hear your response. And this, of course, shows a lower level of cuts than we expect to walk out of here with this year, and shows nothing on oil and gas credit changes to the system.
It does show oil and tax credit changes. House Finance at the kind of in the middle. Under tax credit reform, House Finance is included in there.
Okay, so then if the actual reductions are higher, it's more favorable?
Through the chair, that's correct. Depending on which version of the bill is adopted, the governor has the most impact. House Resources had the least impact. House Finance is pretty much splits the difference.
Brief at ease.
Chair, this is for you. I think it would be helpful. You're already hearing a confusion on the span of the top left graph it might be helpful to have a separate little box at the top or color for the expected $700 million payout and with a spend line below that. I think it might help people understand.
Mr. Teal, if we could, is there a way to put an asterisk on the FY17 line to show in a footnote that we have added $700 million for the payout of the dividend, something to quantify what Senator Machicki and Senator Dunleavy are pointing out? The operating budget is not growing.
Madam Chair, it would be easy to simply include the dividend payments in FY16, if that would make it easier.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, I think what Senator Machicki was saying is, if there's just some way to highlight it for the public that it's a little different spend, because we're talking about the dividend.
Right, which is, I'm saying, by either an asterisk in my count, or Senator Machicki said another line that is showing the operating budget, and then the upper line color would show with the transfer of the dividend itself being placed in our operating budget. So,
and Madam Chair, I think a valid point, because there's been so much talk of the spend level and the Goldsmith model and the sustainable level of spending and so on, and I think it's easy to do that. We can put a second line on there that's the old version of spend.
Thank you. We have other questions. For those, again, at home, we're passing out, passed out to committee members, and we're copying the status quo so that the people can see what the status quo does on a graph and what happens to all of our funds. You see the earnings going out just so that there's status quo so that you can see it. Senator Olson, did you have a question?
Just a short question, Madam Chairman. Mr. Teal, as you look at this, the first chart that was pointed out, obviously we're dealing with a CBR. One of the things that's really has become a major issue, not so much in our body but in the other body, has to do with the three-quarter vote. So this does not do away with the three-quarter vote as long as we're dipping into the CBR all those years ahead of us?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, that's correct. As long as you have a CBR draw and a large earnings reserve balance, you're facing supermajority votes.
No further questions, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. I would like to put on the record that we certainly hope that our counterpart in the other body does do a three-quarter draw, because the money that is currently in the CBR has a rate of return of interest of 2%, and if the legislature is forced to go into the earnings reserved account because we cannot achieve a three-quarter vote, there is a cost to Alaskans in the form of a delta of 4%. That may not be a real number. It might be marginally lower. But the earnings reserve is invested in items that are drawing a higher interest rate for Alaskans. And if we have to go there, that means that we will have to sell those to be able to make that draw. So a three-quarter vote is important. It's in the best interest of Alaska, but it's also in the best interest of Alaska to reduce the budget. And so that will be a conversation that majority and minority members can have, and we'll see how that works out. But this is the Senate's best proposal at this time to fulfill or to close the budget gap and to not impact individual Alaskans with taxes. Senator Machicki.
Question from Mr. Teal, Madam Chair. And this, the governor preferred a fixed draw because he worried about the fluctuation in spend, right? So he wanted to create some stability, and I support that. We want to continue the downward pressure continue to operate, well, improve the operating efficiency of the government we have right now. So the fear is that you're going to have additional funds available when as the fund grows. What is your answer? First of all, I believe a POMV is equally stable, but do you agree with that? And what is your answer to a way to ensure that we don't grow this budget as earnings become more available and that POMV draw grows with the budget?
Senator, through the chair. I think that the governor has been consistent with his review of of this kind of bill, and he is very concerned about stability or volatility, the other side of it. There are things that can be done that would limit spending, but as a legislator, you know that if there's money available, you will be able to spend it. It's really up to the legislature's own restraint in spending. The governor implicitly assumes, I think, that if there's extra revenue, it will all be spent. And that's the primary difference between, I think, Department of Revenue's analysis of our model and the way we look at it, is that we say if revenue is greater than your expenditure line, you save it all. And the governor's office looks at it as, if you have surplus revenue, you will spend it all. The truth is probably somewhere in between that, but it's up to each legislature to spend. There are ways to put rules in place that would limit spending when oil goes up. That's an easy add to a bill like this.
Senator Machicki.
So a follow-up is the stability of a POMB is similar to a fixed draw because it's based on earnings that are not going to fluctuate dramatically. What would create the change would be a fluctuation in oil-related revenue, and that's where you would want to apply the rules, is on the revenue side. Is that correct? So perhaps whatever rule you applied, your worry is in oil revenue, not in earnings.
Through the chair, that's correct. It's really the combination of oil revenue and the POMV payout. And you're correct in saying that the POMV payout is fairly stable. The other oil revenue is not stable. As prices go up and down, our oil revenue goes up and down, and if prices are very high, then what we show as deficits on the graph disappear and become surpluses. The question is, when you have surpluses, do you exercise spending restraint, or because if you do, then you don't have volatility. You only have volatility in spending if you spend that money. And that's your decision. We can't model that.
I can appreciate that. Mr. Teal, thank you. Senator Machicki. Senator Dunleavy.
Yes, Madam Chair, I just want to drive home what Mr. Teal said. History will show that we will spend more money if we have it. And we have to come up with some mechanisms to stop that from happening. And I think, you know, some say that when you have an issue that we're dealing with today, you can either take advantage of it or really take advantage of it. And I think this is the opportunity to really take advantage of it and put some brakes on our desire to spend. I've probably heard 1,000 different reasons why we should spend more money, even though we're at this point we're $4 billion less revenue than we've had in the past. And so all indications are that we will spend the money. And unless we come up with a mechanism along with this spending bill that will go out here shortly and be sent on to the governor, we're going to be back here looking for revenues probably through a tax. Because if we end up tapping into the permanent fund here this year, I don't think that's the end. I think that for some folks, that's going to be the beginning. And so I think we have to look at some mechanisms to cap it.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Mr. Teal and I had a conversation before we introduced and rolled this out, that one way we could do that is put in a draw that could not exceed the $3.3 billion as suggested by the governor. It's a number, and it's a number that the governor modeled under his scenario that was viable and could be a way to hold us inside those parameters. If you have ideas that you'd like to advance to our committee, we are happy to consider how to use those. I would put on the record that in my 10 years here, we return money to the CBR over the top of what was borrowed from the CBR by past legislatures, and that spending, for the most part, if you take out inflation, was done in the capital budget. And so if you read, I was reading the Saudi Arabia analysis for their sovereign wealth fund provided to me by the Department of Revenue and General Richards, and what it shows is a relationship specifically with spending and your capital budget, that those one-time items that you delay on spending. But I think it's a very real fear of Alaskans when you start talking about reducing a dividend and you start talking about taxes, that we have a responsibility to make sure that the communities that we represent understand that we have controlled spending so that there isn't growth in a budget that is irresponsible. Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, just one last comment. I'll get off this. But, you know, we have to keep in mind what Senator Bishop has said on several occasions. We probably have $2 billion worth of unfunded maintenance that we need to take care of in the assets that we have across the state of Alaska. And so we should take this opportunity to really look at a whole different perspective and an overhaul as to how we deal with our assets in terms of taking care of them. And some aspects of the capital fund as well, as you mentioned. But again, I think we're going to have to really have this discussion. That's why I think this is a 2 and 3 year process, to be honest with you. I don't think this is going to be done in 7 days. And I don't think anyone realistically thinks we can do a comprehensive program in 7 days. But we do have some other things that we have to put on the table, such as the maintenance issues that have backlogged on us over the last 30 or 40 years.
Senator Dunleavy, we also have an unfunded pension liability that needs to be taken into consideration. When I spoke with the governor, I said I would like, and pun intended, a governor, like on an engine. Yeah, I was trying to come up with a name. But we needed to have a governor on spending, but we also needed a mechanism to pay off the debts that we owe. And one of those debts is deferred maintenance so that we keep assets available to the people of Alaska, and the other is that those that are retiring from Alaska have an expectation that the benefits that they have earned will be paid. And so I think that that is part of a process. I do think that we can come together on this portion, this leg of the journey, in helping the creditors that are watching Alaska. I think this is a huge step forward. We diversify our revenue stream by almost 40% under this proposal. And I look to Alaskans and to all people who've offered suggestions to help make it even better. But any future legislature can change what we're doing. And you are right, it's the first step on a journey. And we have to do something so that we're not drawing billions of dollars out of our savings account every year. Senator Michicki.
Just on that subject, I think that one of the beautiful things about our Constitution is that we can't tie the hands of future legislatures. However, it's a liability as well. And when you talk about some of those other sovereign wealth funds, rule-based systems work because they can incorporate them essentially in perpetuity. And all of this is just statute, and it can be changed, but I do think we have to focus on criteria and a rules-based approach so that they would have to change that agreement. And that would be a very public process that I think the public would engage in if we didn't have something in statute that limits future draws. And I think it's just one less step that would make it easier for a draw and put us back on a spending incline. And I agree with you, Madam Chair. I think the legislature has been relatively responsible in operating, especially when you adjust for inflation. But those capital fluctuations, I think, resulted in far less savings than we possibly could have had right now today.
Certainly between FY16 and FY17, the Senate has proposed $1 billion worth of cuts, and we'll see where in the operating budget, or right around that number. And so we are hopeful that that we can work together with both bodies to make a plan come together that will work. With that, I don't want to put the administration on the spot, so I will ask, we'll try to bring this bill back up tomorrow if possible, if not the next day, and work with the administration on comments as they digest what we've proposed. And we know that there may be things that we need to change, so again, this document is in pencil, and we look forward to working together. I believe that the status quo document is out so that Alaskans know that we are looking at the budget and what we're spending. We're looking at what fills the budget in the form of diversified revenues. We are looking at how our budget reserves hold. We are looking at dividend checks and how that turns in Alaska's economy. And we are looking at the corpus of the permanent fund and how healthy it stays over long periods of time as far as measurements to a product that would be acceptable to the people of Alaska. With that, Senator Bishop.
Just real briefly, great summation, good comments around the table. I want to thank the chair and the Senator Dunleavy to my left for covering my favorite topic of the budget. But David, and I'm saying David respectfully because I didn't want to say, because I want you to go to the teal colored line over on the right. So real value, effective payout. If you just have a comment how we can keep that at 100% in the out years, what suggestions?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, there are two easy ways to do it. One is to earn more money. The second is to reduce the payout rate from 5.25, which some people think is aggressive. As you can see, the effective payout rate is lower than the stated payout rate, but those are your two levers to help you maintain the real value of the permanent fund.
Thank you.
Cut the budget and draw less from the reserves, or increase revenue through other sources.
Long term, those both would do that, yes.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Tough times for Alaska. This is the Senate's proposal. We wait to hear from Alaskans on the proposal. We know that there are many Alaskans who believe that we can draw money from savings and that we should wait. We wait to hear from Alaskans on this proposal, and we will hear from the administration, I hope, tomorrow, if not the next day, on this consideration. With that, I'd like to take a brief at ease while we change out speakers. Brief at ease. Good afternoon. We're back on the record. The next item before the Senate Finance Committee is HB 188, Persons with Disability Savings Account. If I could invite Representative Dan Sadler and Kim Skipper to the microphones to introduce the bill to the Senate Finance Committee. Representative Sadler, welcome to Senate Finance.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. Thank you very much. For the record, Representative Dan Sadler, House District 13, Eagle River. Pleasure to be back here with the Senate Finance Committee. Certainly an honor to follow up that last piece of legislation that is going to mean so much for Alaskans, thanks to an account. This bill actually should do some good for Alaskans with a much smaller account. This is House Bill 188. It seeks to help Alaskans cope with the challenges of living with a disability by letting individuals and their families set up tax-free savings accounts, which we call ABLE accounts, to pay for education or housing or transportation or other disability-related expenses. Congress passed the Achieving a Better Life Experience, or ABLE Act, in 2014. It authorizes states like ours to create ABLE account programs in their own states, and they're modeled after the very successful 529 college savings programs, which are named after a relevant section of IRS code. And those who have kids heading for college will know that our savings plan, the 529, is one of the best in the nation, which draws account holders from many other states. ABLE accounts let people with disabilities improve their financial security by using their own private investments to supplement benefits from their jobs, if any, their insurance, their supplemental security income, or SSI, Medicaid, or other sources. Assets held in an ABLE account are not to be counted under means tests for Medicaid or SSI, although if an account in the ABLE account goes over $100,000, cash benefits under SSI are temporarily ceased. Contributions are limited to $14,000 per year and capped at $400,000, the same level as allowed by our Alaska 529 College Savings Plan. A person can just have one ABLE account, and if an account holder dies, an ABLE account funds can be used to repay the state for any Medicaid benefits they received during their lifetimes. To be eligible for an ABLE account, a person has to become blind or disabled before the age of 26, and the standard is the same as for disabilities under SSI, either a lifetime or long-term marked and severe impairment of abilities, as certified by a licensed physician. The Alaska Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education estimates that about 10% of Alaskans with disabilities might qualify for an ABLE account. That's about 13,770 people that could qualify. I would note that, for the record, my son might qualify, but I have an informal ethics opinion that indicates because we're part of a much larger class of people, there is no violation. And I'll certainly declare it on the floor. The Mental Health Trust Authority has agreed to pay the $100,000 in the costs for the first 2 years to pay the marketing and procurement costs to set up the contract. After startup, the program will be paid for by fees charged to participants, which is reflected in the zero fiscal notes in the Department of Revenue and Health and Social Services. Madam Chair, the bill evolved slightly during the legislative process to make sure money in ABLE accounts is not unavailable, is not protected from creditors, should the account holder go bankrupt or not pay his rightful debts. There are some specific benefits to having an Alaska state-authorized ABLE account. First, by passing a bill for our Alaska state, we can join a consortium of other states and obtain the economies of scale and lower account fees for account holders. Second, there will be a local agency, the Department of Revenue, where Alaskans can go for recourse if they have problems with their accounts. Because our contribution limits are matched to the college savings plan, ours is at $400,000. That's among the highest in the nation. And finally, passing this bill would demonstrate our concern for disabled Alaskans by providing them a way to improve their own lives without increasing any state costs. In summary, Madam Chair, HB 188 empowers Alaskans with disabilities and their families to meet more of their life's challenges by relying on private resources without eroding the value of public benefits to which they're entitled. They will be an important tool for helping such people live full, productive lives in their communities. I'd answer any questions and ask for your support of HB 188.
Are there questions from committee members on House Bill 188? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Slaughter, how many people do you think are going to take advantage of this? Have you done an estimate or a study to see what the number of people are going to go and participate in the ABLE accounts?
Yes, sir. Through the chair, Senator Olson, the Governor's Council estimates there's about 130,000 people in Alaska who are disabled, and they figure about 10% of those would qualify and would avail themselves.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
If you look at 13,000 people and you multiply it by the number of the amount of money that they can be putting away, what does that do to, I guess, some of the families that aren't as aren't able to go ahead and take care of this, and what does that do to the health and social services budget, for example, and those others?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, actually would do nothing to the department's budget. This is an opportunity for people who would create these accounts to deposit private funds, not state funds, into the accounts. Frankly, it would be to their benefit and might actually benefit the Department of Health and Social Services. There may be needs people would turn to Medicaid or for grants for fulfilling that they might be able to fulfill on their own by having an account in the able balance.
Further questions, Madam Chair?
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
Quick one, Representative Sadler. It looks like the only costs are stand-up costs in FY17 and FY18, and those costs are covered by the Mental Health Trust Authority. Is that correct?
That is correct. Through the chair, Senator Machicki. The Mental Health Trust, many of their beneficiaries are disabled people, and they believe that this is going to be a benefit to their beneficiaries, so they're willing to pay the costs for the contract administration to set up the account with the vendor and the initial marketing costs to make sure that Alaskans with disabilities know about it and can take advantage of it. Afterwards, fees will support the program, and there's no cost to the state.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Representative Sadler, are you ready to do a walkthrough of a sectional analysis for the committee? And Ms. Skipper, if you could identify yourself for the record and take us through a sectional walkthrough.
Brief at ease.
Brief at ease.
Thank you.
We're back on the record. Ms. Skipper, if we could have a walkthrough and sectional analysis.
Through the chair, my name is Kim Skipper, staff to Representative Dan Sadler. I have the CS, a sectional analysis for CS for House Bill 188 Finance Version G. Section 1 cites this as the ABLE Act, Alaska ABLE Act Savings Programs Act. Section 2 creates a new Chapter 65. It's the Alaska Savings Program for Eligible Individuals. Under that area, we have Section 0665010. That's the program authorizes the program. Section 020, General Department Duties for the Department of Revenue. 0665030 is the modification of the program. 040 is the additional department powers, which allows the department to set the fees and transactions and services for developing the program. Section 0665050, contracting authority for and a procurement exemption from the state procurement code. This section allows the state to either do the work themselves, contract it out, or partner with another state. Section 065060 is investment oversight and allows the department to oversee and approve the selection of the investment managers. 070 is the financial contractor obligations. 080 is additional audits. It allows the department to audit the contractors' financial operations who are managing the account. 090 is the contract termination or non-renewal. If we need to find another contract to do the work, they're entitled to do so. 100 is who is eligible for the account. 110 is the representative of eligible individuals who can act as representative if an account holder is not able to do so themselves. 120 is program account ownership. It states that the owner of the program account is the designated beneficiary. Number 130, the number of program accounts, it allows only a beneficiary to have only one ABLE account. 140, the program account application, it outlines the department procedures. 150, program account establishment fee. It allows the financial contractor to charge non-refundable program account fees, which is the part that would help the account to be sustainable in the future. 160 is the program account contributions. This sets the limits of the contributions to account at $14,000 per person, and it's based on federal law through the IRS. 170 is limited investment directions. It limits the investments to the number of times a year is to two times a year for the program account investment to be changed. 180 is the change of designated beneficiary. It allows a designated beneficiary or representative to change a beneficiary to another eligible individual in the family. 190 is distribution of qualified expenses. States that the withdrawals from the program accounts may be only used for qualified expenses, and that is also designed by the IRS. 200, rollover distribution, it's subject to the federal law governing the rollovers. 210, statements, it requires that statements from the program accounts be issued four times a year to the department. 220 is the preparation and filing. In addition to other reports, a financial contractor shall prepare and file statements required under state and federal law to the agency. 230 is a separate accounting. It requires financial contractors to provide separate accounting for the program account. 240 is the annual fee. It allows a financial contractor that can change or charge an annual fee for maintenance. 250, it's used as security. This prohibits a program account from being used as security for a loan. 260, no state obligation. This declares that the program does not create an obligation to the state, the department, or any agency to guarantee the return of principal or interest on the account. 270, confidentiality, specifies the program account information is confidential. 280, exchange of information, allows the Department of Health and Social Services to contact with other agencies to determine whether an individual is eligible. 290, treatment under means test program. This is the section that specifies the program account is disregarded in determining eligibility on means test programs. 300, deposit from permanent fund dividend. It allows deposits to the account from the permanent fund dividend. 310, program expense fund. It establishes program expense fund and describes its purpose. 320 is the Medicaid claims. This is the area where if you have Medicaid, you've received Medicaid benefits, it can claw back and reimburse the state and the federal government. 330, the governing law, establishes federal law is governing to the extent of any conflict. 340, regulations, requires department to adopt implementing regulations. 350, the annual report, it requires the department to evaluate the program each year and file a report starting at the legislative session beginning 2018. 390 is the definition sections. Section 3, AS 36.3850B, adds ABLE program account oversight as a responsibility of the Commissioner of Revenue. 4, AS 4025-120, it's amended to create an exemption to public inspection for names, addresses, and other program account. 5,
AS... Skipper, what page are you on?
I'm sorry, the second page. Third page, at the bottom. Excuse me, Madam Chair.
I'm trying to look on the bill. That's how I've been following you on the bill, not on the... Brief at ease. It's page what? 11? I was on 11.
Okay.
Ms. Skipper.
Through the chair, it's quite a long sectional analysis. Tedious. Section 5 is AS 45.55.990. 32, it excludes the program accounts from the definition of security. top of page 4, section 6 is AS4707055. It allows the state to file a claim against a designated beneficiary's program account after the individual dies. Section 7 is the transitional section. It requires the department to file its first report on the program on or before the first day of the second regular session of the 30th Alaska Legislature in 2018. Section 8 is a transitional section allowing the department to adopt the regulations, but not before the provisions, effective date of the provisions authorizing the Alaska Able Savings Program. And Section 9 is the effective date, which takes effect immediately.
Are there questions from committee members? Thank you, Ms. Skipper. Thank you, Representative Sadler. With that, I'd like to open the public hearing on House Bill number 188, Finance, /G. Is there anyone here in Juneau wishing to testify on House Bill 188? Is there anyone online or in an Alaska LIO wishing to testify on 188? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. I would like to go to Stewart's, is it Spielman in Washington, D.C.? Mr. Spielman, are you there?
Stewart Spielman. I'm Senior Policy Advisor and Counsel for Autism Speaks, and Autism Speaks is the nation's largest autism science and advocacy organization, and I want to commend Representative Sadler and the proponents of this legislation. The autism community strongly supports this legislation, and we have seen 40 states enact ABLE legislation, and we are looking forward to Alaska joining with the other states in putting forward this legislation and an ABLE program.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to go to Margaret Brody from Division of Health Care Services, Department of Health and Social Services. Director Brody, do you have any questions or comments that the committee should consider on HB 188?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Margaret Brody. I'm the Director of Health Care Services for the state of Alaska. I don't know that anybody has pointed out, but there is a potential benefit that we see here. We do the subrogation and the state recovery for Medicaid, and I see that over time that these accounts will probably diminish the amount of the buy-in that we have for disabled individuals and the Miller Trust Fund. So I see a shift in the work. It's going to be the same kind, but a little bit easier, and I see it shifting that way as time goes on.
Director Brody, does the administration have a position on this bill?
Madam Chair, we support this bill.
Thank you very much. Kristen Vandegrift, Alaska Governor Council on Disabilities and Special Education. I know that you're online for questions. Ms. Vandegrift, do you have anything the committee should consider?
Just that the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education is definitely in support of this bill and sees it as a great tool for individuals with disabilities and their families to not only be more independent and self-sufficient, but to look at being able to join the workforce as well, which is a great thing.
Thank you very much. With that, I would like to, public hearing has been opened and closed. We've heard from invited speakers. With that, we'll set aside 188. I would direct the committee to HB 83, brief at ease. We're back on the record. The CS for House Bill 83, Judiciary Version E, is before us. Well, I'd like to welcome to the table Representative Ledoux and her staff, Amy Michelle. Representative Ledoux, welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Senator Fairclough. I apologize if we haven't provided the sectional analysis. The person handling this bill previously was Courtney Enright. Her sister's the sole survivor in that plane crash of the one that went down between Wrangell and Angoon. So we're trying to.
Representative Ledoux, we have the sectional. It's just not passed out. So your staff has done everything that they should do.
And we're fine. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, we're all together. And if you could present HB 83 to us.
Yes, I will. Madam Chair, my name is Gabrielle Ledoux. I represent Muldoon and the Elmendorf portion of J-Bear. Basically, what House Bill 83 does, it eliminates the automatic reporting of information about civil case settlements currently required by law. This bill follows the advice of the Judicial Council, which has recommended that the legislature do away with this requirement. Passing this bill would save money and time by freeing attorneys and litigants from the unnecessary and functionally useless submission of data, which the Judicial Council sees no point in collecting. I've got my staff here, Amy Michelle. She can answer any further questions. And we also have online Suzanne DiPietro from the Judicial Council and a private attorney, Ken Jacobus, who can talk to this.
Are there questions of the sponsor on what the bill does? Ms. Michelle, if you could walk us through the sectional. I know that there's not much there, but we try to let the general public know what each section is supposed to do as they follow along.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Amy Michelle. The bill is a one-page document, and in Section 1, it repeals Rule 41A3, the Alaska Rules of the Civil Procedure, and Rules 511C and E, Rules of the Appellate Procedure. In Section 2, it repeals AS 0968130, which was the required language for the Judicial Council to collect this information. And then in Section 3, it talks about how this act requires a two-thirds vote for passage. In Section 4, it provides an effective date.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, thank you for presenting your bill. We'd like to open the public testimony on House Bill 83. The first person in the Anchorage LIO is Sarah Batten. Sarah, if you could identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed with 3 minutes of testimony.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
We can. Welcome to Senate Finance.
Thank you. Yes, I'm a private attorney here in Anchorage, and we've testified on this before, and I know you have the information. I just want to support the repeal of this requirement for many reasons that I've testified to before, and I want to keep it brief. So one thing I do want to make sure everyone is aware of, that repealing this will save money, save time, and most importantly, when I bill my time at an hourly rate, I do that on contract law, and generally that requires that my billing time be passed through to certain debtors. And so this is not only going to save the attorney's time and money, the Judiciary Council time and money, but it's going to save debtors who are required to pay back attorney's fees time and money. I'm free to answer any questions.
Sarah, thank you for joining Senate Finance. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, the next person at the Anchorage LAO is Ken Jacobus. Ken, are you there?
Yes, Madam Chairman, I'm here. I'll make my testimony brief. This is an extremely important bill to those of us who are affected. What it does is it makes criminals out of a whole bunch of attorneys and the law. It should be repealed. Out of a whole bunch of attorneys and a whole bunch of civil litigants without attorneys who are required to file this information but don't file it for some reason. I think a lot of it is they don't know they have to do it. There's no enforcement. There's no compliance. The compliance rate is somewhere, I think, between 10 and 15%. This repeal is objected to by nobody. It's been supported by resolutions of the Alaska Bar Association, the Anchorage Bar Association, the Klamath Valley Bar Association. We never asked Juno for a resolution, but I'm sure they wouldn't oppose it. Where we are, though, is it saves a lot of money for litigants, for attorneys, for the state of Alaska. It doesn't have to process data that it doesn't even need. There was a need for it in the past, but there isn't a need for it now. Unlike Sarah Batten, I don't bill my clients for this. I absorb it as part of the overhead of my office. But it's really something that does need to be repealed. We would request that you pass it out to the committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you. Any questions? I'll be happy to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Jacobus. Are there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, is there anyone else online or off-net wishing to testify on House Bill 83? Anyone here in Juneau? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. Representative Ledoux, is there any closing comments that the committee should consider in reviewing your legislation?
Nothing other than that I would really appreciate if you passed the bill out.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. There are members at this table that hope that you do the same. With that, brief at ease, and we'll move on to the next bill. The next bill before us is House Bill 289. The sponsor of the bill is Representative Gabrielle Ledoux. Welcome to Senate Finance. Representative Ledoux, if you would introduce yourself for the record, your staff, and then please proceed with telling us what House Bill 289 does.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. It's nice to be here again. My name is Gabrielle Ledoux. I represent Muldoon and the Elmendorf portion of J-Bear. I'm here with my staff, Amy Michelle. This bill relates, House Bill number 289, it relates to the membership of the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers. Bill does several things. Number one, it makes the board, it increases the members of the board from 6 members to 7 members. The board wanted that because sometimes you end up with 6 members and you end up with a tie vote. So you can't have a tie with 7 members. The second thing that the board does is it decreases the number of persons who are appointed for the designated barber's seat. Under this bill, from 2 persons to 1 person, and the reason for that is there just basically aren't enough barbers in this state, so they have problems actually appointing a barber to the board. Another thing that the bill does is it adds 1 person licensed to practice manicuring under this bill. And last year, we increased the requirements, the number of hours of training for nail technicians but we never gave them a seat at the table for the board, and this bill does this. And then finally, it adds one person licensed to practice any activity licensed under this chapter. And so that, in a nutshell, is the bill. And this bill was requested by the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. Are there questions from committee members? Gentlemen, there are two sections to this bill, and Representative Ledoux just went through that. Would you like a sectional? We'll open the public hearing then. I'm opening the public hearing on House Bill number 289. Is there anyone here in Juneau wishing to testify on HB 289? Seeing and hearing none, I'll go to Wasilla. Glenda LaFord. Glenda, are you there? And if you could identify yourself and any affiliation, and then please proceed with 3 minutes of testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Glenda Ledford, and I am the current chair of the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers for the state of Alaska. With this bill, it would give the manicurist a seat at the table, since we increased their hours of education last year. We have over 900 manicurists in this state, and I currently hold a chair of a seat at the table as a barber. We have another chair at the seat, and so therefore we only have over 100, somewhere between 100 and 125 barbers in the state. So they are well represented. If we decrease the number of barbers on the board to one, and then we open a seat up to whatever you are licensed in, then in the future, that gives us more room to fully represent the people that this board covers. The board unanimously voted to support this bill. And does anybody have any questions at this time?
Thank you for your testimony, Glenda. Is there questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, the next person online waiting to testify is Janine Jabe. Janine, are you there?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Janine Jabe, and I'm the public member of the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of House Bill 289, which positively restructures the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers. And on behalf of the entire Board of Barbers and Hairdressers, which offers its complete support to this bill, I also want to thank Representative Ledoux for introducing this bill and Lisa McGuire for carrying the Senate version of this bill in SB 168. Currently, the Board of Barbers and Hairdressers is a six-member board which governs the licenses of Alaska's barbers, hairdressers, nail technicians, manicurists, estheticians, tattoo artists, body piercers, and permanent cosmetic colorists. The Board of Barbers and Hairdressers governs the third largest number of licensees in the state, just below nursing and real estate. As Representative Ledoux stated, House Bill 289 is a two-part bill. One, it adds a seventh member to the board to provide representation for nearly 1,000 unrepresented licensees, the nail technicians and manicurists of Alaska. And secondly, we are currently overrepresented by the barbering industry. It spreads overrepresentation of the barbers to the entire board of licensees. In 2015, the legislature passed a bill which requires nail technicians to obtain an education and pass a board examination. This excellent piece of legislation, thank you very much for that, protects our community and validates the nail technician industry. Now there are almost 1,000 currently licensed manicurists and nail technicians in the state that do not have a board seat, and we're asking the legislature to pass House Bill 289, which gives representation to these licensees, and it adds a seventh member to the board. This creates an odd number of board members, which we believe is best practice for our small board, which governs a very large number of licensees. Our current statute requires a majority present to hold a quorum, so two absences completely helps progress. By adding a seventh member, we're able to more easily obtain a quorum. Additionally, our board is structured to have two of our six seats filled by barbers. When the statute was originally created, the state of Alaska had nearly 1,200 barbers, and as of January of this year, that number was at only 152. With two statute-required board seats, we believe there is now over-representation of barbers on the board, And additionally, since we have such a small pool of barber licenses to pull from, there has been great challenges to fill the board. There simply aren't enough barbers within the state to fill two board seats without major gaps between vacancies. Since I joined the board almost 3 years ago, one of the barber seats remained vacant for nearly a full year. House Bill 289 takes one of those board seats and allows any of our board's governed licensees to fill it, be it a barber, a hairdresser, an esthetician, tattoo artist, or any of the others. This gives our board the ability to recruit from the entire pool of governed licenses. Additionally, it will allow board flexibility to allow for our state licensing changes, meaning if we have a particular industry within our licensees grow, we'll be able to give them a seat at the table without going through the legislative process again. With regards to the fiscal note, I would like to mention that our board is receipt-supported and continues to be in the black. Any associated costs with adding a seventh board member would be limited to travel reimbursement and would be paid directly by the licensing fees obtained through our board. We are not asking the state for any funding. The fiscal note attached is simply to authorize reimbursement for the seventh board member, which will be funded with by our licensing fees. This bill holds a zero general fund fiscal note. And if the legislature would like any additional research, I'm very happy to come to Juneau and facilitate a field trip to nearby nail salon or barber. I appreciate your time, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you, Janine. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Amy, I'm curious why the decline in barbers.
Janine?
Through the chair, yeah, we don't really know why. I believe barbers have a 1,650 required hours, as do hairdressers. Maybe men's hair is falling out. I don't know.
There goes your due pass.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Is there anyone else in Juneau or throughout Alaska in an LIO or off-net wishing to testify on House Bill 289? Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. Representative Ledoux, thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Bertel. McKinnon.
Thank you, Representative Ledoux. It's nice to see you.
Nice to see you.
If I could direct the committee's attention, we have two more bills before us. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. The next bill before us is House Bill 231, Extension of the Board of Parole. Representative Lynn is not here. Is it Esther? Esther, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then please present HB 231.
Hello. For the record, my name is Esther Milkey, staff to Representative Lynn. He would have liked to be here, but he couldn't be here this afternoon. But on his behalf, the Board of Parole currently serves in Alaska as the authority over parole setting. It is currently set in statute to be terminated on June 30, 2016. HB 231 originally extended the date to June 30, 2022, but the most current version of the bill, which was passed by Senate State Affairs, extends it to June 30, 2020. This is a four-year extension. The Division of Audit did an audit on the Board of Parole last year. The audit includes an examination of the board's performance in light of the 11 sunset criteria points provided within Alaska statute. The Division of Audit found the board to be in good standing, but provided four recommendations to improve their operations, which address, one, the accuracy and consistency of information contained in parole files, two, the documentation of victim and notar of and offender notifications, three, deficiencies in proposed regulation changes methods, and four, the security of the Department of Corrections information system. In response to the audit, the Board of Parole provided responses to the identified recommendations. Likewise, the Department of Corrections generally agreed with the recommendations. HB 231 fulfills the constitutional requirement that the state establish a board, a parole system, and accordingly assists in keeping Alaskans safe. As you can see, the bill also has a fiscal note, which covers the board's operating costs, which were included in the budget. We have available for questions myself and Sherry Deagle from the Department of Corrections, Chris Curtis from Legislative Audit, and Jeff Edwards from the Board of Parole should be online.
Are there questions from committee members? Thank you, Esther, for presenting the bill. I'd like to invite Chris Curtis, Legislative Auditor, to the table.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Chris Curtis, Legislative Auditor. We did conduct a sunset review of the Board of Parole to determine whether it was serving the public's interest and whether it should be extended. We did generally conclude that it conducts its business in a professional and efficient manner, and we recommended a 6-year extension. We didn't go for the maximum 8-year extension because of the uncertainties right now with the corrections field. They also implemented a new risk assessment tool that we felt warranted legislative oversight earlier than 8 years. So we could come out with a 6-year recommendation. We had four recommendations that Esther went through at a high level to improve operations. These are more administrative and did not impact our recommendation for extension. If you have the audit in front of you, page 9 has to do with improving procedures to ensure required documentation for parole hearings is accurate and consistently included in parole files. We sampled 38 parole files, found several errors in the documentation, such as calculating the risk assessment, tabulating the assessment. We noted instances where the risk assessment forms or the parole applications were missing from the file. So just to general improve the documentation. Recommended that the executive director work with the Department of Corrections Management in implementing documentation standards to ensure all offender and victim notifications were made in accordance with statutory requirements. Essentially, the board's regulations have delegated this authority to the Department of Corrections. We went in through our testing of parole files to verify that offender notifications and victim notifications were happening. We could not verify that because of a lack of documentation. We do believe the notifications are happening because we did not find complaints, but we could not verify due to the lack of documentation. So we also believe this could be an easy fix. Page 11, we recommend the board ensure proposed regulations address all statutory requirements. There is a statutory requirement. The regulations specifically address how the board is going to determine suitability of a prisoner for special medical and discretionary parole. The regulations in place at the time we did the audit describe the risk assessment tool, which has been replaced by something called the LSIR tool. And they went to go change regulation to describe this new tool, and Department of Law recommended that they don't include this information in the regulations. Therefore, in the future, when they change tools, they don't have to spend the time changing regulations, which really does seem reasonable and efficient. However, statutes require that they include a description of their tool in the regulations. So this is, again, an administrative type of recommendation. And then finally, on page 12, we recommend the Department of Corrections Admin Services Director take steps to ensure that their offender management system complies with information security standards and industry best practices. The information of this recommendation has been withheld. The details have been withheld from the report to prevent them from being exploited. We did provide the details to the Department of Corrections. They provided us detailed corrective action.
And in general, the department and the board concurred with all recommendations.
Are there questions from committee members?
Thank you, Ms. Curtis.
With that, I'd like to open up the public hearing. On House Bill 231, State Affairs version in as in November, is there anyone here in Juneau wishing to testify on House Bill 231? Is there anyone off-net or online wishing to testify on House Bill 231? With that, the public hearing is closed. I'd like to go to Mr. Jeff Edwards, the director of the Parole Board at the Department of Corrections. Mr. Edwards, are you there?
Yes, Madam Chair. Jeff Edwards, the executive director of the Parole Board here.
Mr. Edwards, we're not covering fiscal notes, but I see that it is costing the state of Alaska in general fund dollars $1 million to monitor this board. Can you tell us, I'm sure it's on the fiscal note. Well, no, it's not. Can you tell us how many employees or how many staff you have? It'll be in the audit report also.
Yes, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Jeff Edwards of the Parole Board. I have six staff members, including myself, dedicated full-time employees. And I also have five governor-appointed Parole Board members. They're the actual city members of the board. I guess for simplicity purposes, we consider them part-time board members. And they get paid when and if they work for the board in making their decisions. They also get paid for travel reimbursement. They get an honorary for setting conditions and making the board decisions. So we consider them to be part-time employees.
Mr. Edwards, you're going to need to defend your $1 million.
Madam Chair, we believe our service is vastly going to be expanded through the possibility of Senate Bill 91. And why I bring that up is because the commission, not only criminal justice commissions on a national level, actually a global level, the paroling authorities throughout the country have been expanded and their duties are asked to be increased because of the viability of sentencing laws, because of what happens in criminal justice reform. As more and more people become incarcerated, we are the only agency that can release individuals early who have earned it and just hold a low risk. So in the best interest of warehousing low risk people that have demonstrated that they have reformed, they have programmed, they've educated themselves and are low risk, the Department of Corrections feel as though that warehousing these folks in a hard bed for, you know, $46,000 a year is not a viable solution and in best interest of the state of Alaskans. We feel that the paroling authority, in making their decisions, evaluating the risk of individuals, and garnishing a second chance for some people to go back out on parole, to be released from a hard bed, to transition, those who've demonstrated that they can be successful members of our society. Instead of warehousing them in hard bed, we feel that releasing them in a systematic way with the utilization of best practices through risk assessments and reentry programs to bond with community services and allow people to release under the supervision of the parole board is a better, even more efficient use of financial resources. I did a rough calculation, I think it was a couple of years back, of just how much money, and I don't have the specifics, Madam Chair, so I do apologize, I don't want to get pinned down with erroneous facts, but we believe we saved the Department of Corrections millions of dollars in displacing hard bed costs, and so based on our overall operating costs of just under $1 million, when we save, and we look at the expansion of SB 91, we're going to be saving and be at the forefront of saving those hard bed costs to the Department of Corrections.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Edwards, I'd like to request, I don't mind the other costs, those are fairly self-explanatory, but if we can just get a breakdown of the $852,000 in personal services, I think that would be helpful for me. Madam Chair?
Senator Machicki, yes. Sarah Machicki, I'm looking at the audit under page 1, organization and function. The last paragraph shows that in FY15 we were budgeted and expended $896,700, and it appears that there was a vacancy of one additional staff person, and so I'm wondering how long that position was vacant.
Madam Chair, that position was vacant for a period of time. We also had an expansion of the PACE program, which provided us an additional staff position that was not originally filled due to the fact that we didn't have our program up and running, and it took us a little bit of time to get some national experts on the paroling program through the PACE. And then once we got the program up and running, we filled that position. And so it was vacant, ma'am, for some months while we built our new program that was legislatively mandated through, I believe it was Senate Bill 64 some years ago.
Mr. Edwards, was it vacant all of FY15?
Madam Chair, I'll have to get back to you. I don't believe so, but I'll have to get back to you on that one if I could.
Thank you. I'm just looking at a $100,000 difference in FY15 to now in the same position count. So it appears that there was a vacancy for quite a while. Did I hear you say that you're dovetailing in with the PACE program and there's another position associated with the work that you do?
Yes, ma'am. There was one position, one PCN designated to the parole board to support the PACE program.
And so does that mean that you're managing six individuals, or does someone else manage the PACE program?
Ma'am, the Department of Corrections supervises the individuals on the actual program. Our role is identifying who would be acceptable for the program. If violations occur, we need to react in a swift and certain manner to deal with the violations. And that person is also tasked with doing data analysis and providing data for the department on behalf of the department as to the effectiveness of the program.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards. If you could provide us a written document as Vice Chairman Machicki asked on the personnel lines, and if you could, I can go back and look with legislative finance to see what your travel line looked like if you actually expended the $52,000 there. So if you could provide an email to the committee, that would be advantageous. With that, I'd like the committee to set aside HB 231. The last bill before the committee today is HB 268. If I could, I'd like to open the public testimony. We're losing folks, Senator Terrio. So let me see if there's anyone online that's been waiting for a while. I'd like to open the public hearing on House Bill 268. Is there anyone off-net, online, or here in Juneau to testify on House Bill 268, an act relating to the dividend from the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority relating to the meaning of market-to-market fair value, net income, project or development, and unrestricted net income for the purposes of the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority and providing for an effective date. Seeing and hearing none, the public hearing is closed. There you go. Sorry, you're good. Thank you, Senator Machicki. Mr. Terrio, if you'd like to introduce yourself for the record, and then please present your bill.
Yes, Madam Chairman. Gene Terrio, staff to ADA, and Michael Lamb, the Chief Financial Officer for ADA, is available to answer technical questions. I'll try and go through quickly the contents of the bill. There is a slide presentation, I believe you have a hard copy, that gives some examples of the two problems that we're trying to deal with here. The first problem is what we call the mark-to-market fair market adjustments. In order for ADA to get its audited financial statement, new accounting rules require that different assets that are held by the authority be evaluated and mark-to-market adjustments be made at a certain point during the fiscal year. Basically, what that is you take a snapshot and try and capture any unrealized gain in an asset or any unrealized loss, and then you actually book it as if you sold the asset. You haven't sold the asset, though, so it's a non-cash adjustment to the accounts that is bringing an unnecessary amount of volatility to the calculation of the dividend to the state treasury. So if you look on page one of the bill, there is a definition of mark-to-market, fair market of value. And then when we get to page two, if you'll look on the copy of the bill that's in front of you, on 9-3, page 2, you can see that previously the legislature included an exclusion mechanism in the calculation of the net income for purposes of ADA paying a dividend. What we're proposing to do is add those mark-to-market evaluations to that exclusion. So those things that we have to do in order to get our ART financial statement, those non-cash adjustments would be backed out. We would get back to true net income of the authority, and that's what our dividend would be calculated on. The second problem that ADA is trying to deal with here is what we call the dividend penalty. Previously, the legislature said when ADA received an appropriation from an outside source of money, it could be the state general fund, federal funds, project proponent cash coming in to the authority. In order for that that revenue to be shown on ADA's books, ADA had to show it as income coming onto the books. The legislatures instructed ADA at the time to, once that started happening, to disregard those outside sources of money for purposes of calculating the dividend. And if you think about it, if a capital appropriation was given to the authority by the legislature, say $1,000. If ADA had to bring that on as and show it as net income, when it came time to calculate the dividend, we would end up giving a portion of that money back to the legislature. And the legislature said, that's not what we meant. If it's an outside source of money, disregard those things. Don't let those outside sources of money spike your net income artificially for purpose of calculating the dividend. What the legislature failed to realize at that time is every once in a while those outside sources of money are used to pay for an EIS or buy some asset, and a project may not ultimately go forward. ADA eventually has to then write that asset off the books, and when that is done, it artificially suppresses the net income for that particular year. Those reductions or write-offs happen very infrequently. But we figured while we had a piece of legislation that was proposing a change to the calculation of the dividend, we would capture those, insert some language that would capture those periodic sale or write-offs of assets, so again that the state dividend would not be suppressed in a year when one of those write-downs takes place. So on page two of the bill, in two different spots, we're adding a number of things, these non-cash adjustments or the write-off of an asset that was purchased with an outside source of money to the exclusion clause that was already established by the legislature, so we can get back to true net income and base our yearly dividend to the state treasury on true net income and remove unnecessary volatility in the calculation of those dividends.
Further questions from committee members?
Do we have a sectional walkthrough of the bill, Senator
Terry? Yeah, Madam Chairman, there is a sectional analysis. It basically goes over and breaks out the two problems again. The mark-to-market adjustments indicates when those are being corrected, and then the second problem being that dividend penalty when an asset purchased with an outside source of money has to be written off the books. Those are the two things that are being corrected in Section 1. Section 2 is just an immediate effective date on the legislation.
Are there questions from committee members? Thank you for that presentation.
Okay. Madam Chairman, just one other thing. Right now we are dealing with one of the GAAP and GASB rules that is causing volatility. There are new rules that are in the queue to come into place. If those rules are driven by the same dynamics in the economy, the they're going to start stacking up on top of each other. And the swings and the volatility of the dividend are going to become more pronounced. So that's what we're trying to do, is put a mechanism into place that will account for those rules that are in the queue, going to come into being, and also will capture and adjust for future rules.
Thank you so much. Mr. Michael Lamb, do you have any comments the committee should consider in reviewing House Bill 268?
Madam Chair, I think Ms. Cherio did a fine job. The summary really is we're trying to fix the mark-to-market, and as you said, the other issue is very infrequent, but let's just fix it. So I have no comments, ma'am.
Mr. Lamb, are you with Ada, and if you could give us your position?
Yes, ma'am. Sorry, I'm the Chief Financial Officer.
And Mr. Lamb, does this have anything to do with purchasing a gas utility?
No.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any other questions? With that, we'll set House Bill 268 aside. That concludes Senate Finance's agenda for the day. I would like to put on the record that the bills that were heard today, amendments are due by tomorrow at noon. So if anyone has questions about that, the exception may be HB 188 that has some securities issues in it. And so while the amendments are due, I think that we may have some questions on HB 88, but I'm just not sure. It was a little bit more complex than some of the other issues from my perspective that just came before us. So right now, amendments are due, with the exception of HB 188, are due tomorrow, Wednesday, April 13th, and amendments are due on HB 188 by Thursday, April 14th at noon. With that, the committee is adjourned.